Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 28th, 1998. In the Cornania Fireside Room this morning is Paul Rohde. Today's session number is 98-2, and it's titled, Give Us This Day, Israelites in the Wilderness. Let's listen in.
Welcome to Bible study. For any of you who may not have been here yesterday, my name is Paul Rohde. When I'm not at Holden Village, I'm a pastor of Our Savior's Lutheran Church in New Ulm, Minnesota. And eager to be attentive to the Bible with you. As I said to the folks yesterday, I have two hopes. One is that we will hear the word. And the other is that we will make some discoveries of hearing that the Word hears us, that it knows us. It's powerful to know the Bible, but I think it's even more powerful to discover that the Bible knows us. We're working sort of on the Lord's Prayer, calling this Portraits of Prayer, listening to the people in the Bible in prayer. Today we're going to listen to the Israelites in the wilderness, in Exodus chapter 16. Exodus 16. They set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin. I really believe this is just a geographical description, that there's not a theological interpretation here, though you might be tempted to think so, that the wilderness is named Sin in this place, which is between Elim and Sinai. On the 15th day of the second month, after they had departed from the land of Egypt. So the chapter sets us in context, but just to make sure we're clear, the beginning of the book of Exodus finds the people of Israel in horrible oppression in Egypt. The firstborn sons have begun to be killed because the Pharaoh fears that they will rise up against them. Moses is saved out of the rushes. The name Moses means out of the rushes. Remember that great story with Moses' mom putting him in that basket? And in the River Nile. Then Moses is called, the theophany, the appearance of God to Moses in the wilderness, reluctantly, that may be important for this story, accepts this call of God to lead the people out. Moses has come to the Pharaoh, said, let my people go. And the Pharaoh, we're all shocked, says no. And then we have the plagues, the 10 plagues. They have all happened. The 10th plague, of course, is the death of the firstborn sons of the Egyptians. The angel of death passed over the houses of the Israelites, and then the Israelites are delivered. After they're released and set out of the Pharaoh's house, Pharaoh changes his mind and decides to pursue them. They get the Red Sea in front of them and the Pharaoh's army behind them, and Moses raises his rod and his staff. You've seen the movie Charlton Heston. That great moment. And the children of Israel are set free. That happens in Exodus 14. Exodus 15 is their song of praise. First Moses leads them in song, and then Miriam dances with her drum. And they sing their praise to God. And now we're at Exodus 16. And the story says we're 6 weeks past that great exodus, the coming out, the setting free and deliverance of the people of Israel. I used to believe, Exodus 16 is one of the chapters that changed this belief, but I used to believe that if I could have been there and have seen Moses and his rod and the water standing with a wall and the pillar of God, a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night, that never again would I question the power or presence of God. I used to believe that. And I think Exodus 16 helps us know why we are who we are, and why perhaps the one word that is repeated in the Lord's Prayer is the word daily. Give us this day our daily bread. And the whole congregation of the people of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness and said to them, "Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." I challenge you to find in the book of Exodus or in any other document some description of the Israelites relaxing by the flesh pots and eating to the full. I've read the book of Exodus countless times. It isn't there, folks. I mean, in fact, it might be good to just look back at what is there. Turn back to Exodus 1 quickly. Exodus 1, verses 13 and 14. Actually, I'll start with half of verse 12. "And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel, so they made the people of Israel serve with rigor and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. And in all their work, they made them serve with rigor." And we get another description in chapter 2, verse 23. "And the people of Israel groaned under their bondage and cried out for help. And their cry under bondage came up to God, and God heard their groaning." But by the time we get to chapter 16, see, 6 weeks later, these are the good old days. And the Bible gives us what I think. I mean, this isn't really about prayer, but I'll just throw it in, no extra charge. What I think is one of the most stunning critiques of nostalgia. You know, that kind of rose tinting of what's behind us. And I want to say a few things about that to you, because even if you don't think you need a critique of nostalgia, your pastor does. So that when the voices in your congregation, I think every congregation has them, the voices are murmuring, "Well, we used to." See when the voices are saying that? If you'd like to give your pastor a gift, you just smile wryly and say, "Lusting for the flesh pots of Egypt." And I'm here to tell you, for your pastor, it's better than fruitcake at Christmas. It wasn't so sweet in Egypt, but we have, I mean, now to get to the point, we have new and important verbs for prayer, kind of about collecting a verb vocabulary for prayer. And the first verb I want us to work on is hunger. I told the 745 folks, I was a little surprised. We had spent more time discussing hunger at 7:45. And they all said, "Well, we just had breakfast." And that is in itself a really important interpretive point. I'm not very good at Spanish pronunciation, but Gustav Gutierrez, I believe is his name, has a stunning statement about how we read the Bible differently when we're hungry. We ought not be surprised. We even shop for groceries different kind of hungry. You know, that's been proven. But I hope you'll find an alertness, okay, to be able to talk about hunger and prayer as expression of hunger, even though you too have just had breakfast and are probably not feeling it at the moment. I think one of the things that I want to say about the, you know, let's just think for a while about what we mean by the word. They complain to God, to Moses and Aaron, of their hunger, it says. Most basically, it means that our bodies need about 3,000 calories a day, right? Or more or less. I mean, I suppose we could discuss exactly how many calories we need, but it's the most basic definition of hunger. And whatever other definitions we give hunger, I don't want us to lose that. We can go back to Hannah, where we imagined Hannah stooped and slouched and weak because she had stopped eating. I don't really want to limit the word hungry to those 3,000 calories. I think poetically it speaks to us on all kinds of levels of yearning and of emptiness. One of the things we talked about yesterday is it's hard to give the things that don't happen a name, you know, to name the absence, the non-event, but hunger is a name for that. I am hungry, and so there, that speaks on all kinds of levels, but we gotta be careful, because one of the things that's happened is that people who've not been hungry have sometimes faced people who are with poetic interpretations of hunger rather than the 3,000 calories. So one of the things I'm eager for us to think about is the way underneath the verb I hunger are either the way feeding is empowering and strengthening, or that withholding food is weakening. Because without food, we are weak. And without expressions of that hunger, we're weak. So prayer the Israelites here, I don't think they even know they're praying, maybe. But they're speaking this hunger. You want to comment about that? Discuss, raise some questions or comments. But hunger, we'll come back to it when we hear how God responds to their hunger.
Oh, you mean the murmuring can be considered a prayer?
Oh, I think so. Okay. Because the other verb that it gives us that we ought to talk about is complaint. Mm-hmm. Complaining is a very good prayer word. And especially because yesterday we were about thinking critically about asking in prayer. And I think today we get a critique of asking from the other side. What happens if you don't ask? How would this have been different if the Israelites had maturely, assertively said, "Will you feed us?" You know, why is it harder to ask than it is to say, "What are you trying to do, kill us?" Which is the way it comes out if you refuse to ask. That in some ways we can hear them not having asked, and then it comes, the murmuring, the critique, the complaint. And it's heard. The world doesn't fall apart because they complain. So I've already added two verbs. Hunger, murmur, or maybe three, murmur and complain. Thanks, similar. Comments, reactions?
Paul?
Yeah.
In chapter 2, while the children of Israel are still in bondage, verse 23, after a long time the king of Egypt died, the Israelites groaned under their slavery and cried out. Out of the slavery, their cry for help rose to God. God heard their groaning and remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac. I've always wondered I don't think they were consciously praying there either, but that groaning under oppression is received as prayer in the ears of God. So, I mean, there's another verb that really does become prayer, just groaning under the weight of injustice.
Or I think of our stomachs growling. Yeah, involuntary.
Involuntary. Right.
And highly embarrassing. I mean, by the end of the last service on Sunday morning, it's like, I'm very careful about microphone placement. And that is not thought of. But you see, the marvelous thing about this, about the word hunger, is the way it embodies prayer. Prayer is not merely cerebral.
Yeah.
You know, thinking it out and getting it explained. I think one of the most enormous limitations to prayer is that we have this sense that we're going to get it all figured out and that we will kind of present it to God. I wish. But yesterday, the words we borrowed from Luther were the children coming in complete confidence to their loving parents. And they come long before it's figured out. That prayer is the gift of non-resolution, this visceral groaning. A wonderful thing about Exodus 16 is we get a rather expansive sense of God's response. So read further. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or not." I guess I'm going to make this comment now. The prayer Jesus taught us put it this way: "Give us this day." I think the most provocative word in that phrase is the word "this." We talk about one day at a time, but that's still generic. It's any day. But this day is definite and particular and specific. Our synod once, 1 year at our synod assembly, had four pastors doing Bible studies throughout the assembly meetings. And our theme was rooted in the gospel. Well, it wasn't real imaginative. We had four presenters and there were four words in the theme. So we decided that each presenter would take one word. I got the word "the." But it was a very challenging assignment. And I started with a dictionary, which will define the definite article, okay? The definite, specific, concrete, particular. We love to talk about loving our neighbors. But the article says love the neighbor. Or the phrase says, love this neighbor. And I'm willing to venture, you've all got a neighbor you're thinking about. It's this neighbor. The way it makes it specific and definite and concrete. I mean, well, I loved the discussion yesterday about triviality in prayer. I thought that was really fun. My sense is that we err too often on the generic, ethereal, theoretic. Then we do the specific, concrete, the this day. And I hear God's willingness to hear. Some of it is because we hear this in the scripture in so many places. Let the day's own troubles be sufficient for the day. And they will go out and gather a day's portion every day, each day, this day. So that it's not only our prayer, but it's God's response that is focused on this hunger. This hunger this day, which, because it's more specific, I think has more power. Okay, they shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may prove them. There's a wonderful word study here on the word "prove," because the same word can be translated tempt or test. This is the word about when Jesus is in the wilderness. The temptation is in the wilderness. It's also the proving of Jesus. And it's the word we get later in the Lord's Prayer. Lead us not into temptation, or do not put us to the test. The proving of discipleship. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily. So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, "At evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your murmurings against the Lord. For what are we that you murmur against us?" And Moses said, "When the Lord gives you in the evening flesh to eat, and in the morning bread to the full, because the Lord has heard your murmurings which you murmur against him, what are we? Your murmurings are not against us, but against the Lord. You have to appreciate Moses didn't want this job in the first place. And you know, the other verb I hear rumbling around underneath this is intercess. Okay? It's the mediator that the people cry out against Moses and Aaron. They complain to Moses and Aaron. Moses and Aaron then are the intercessors who bring their prayer to God and who bring to their consciousness that their murmuring and their complaining and their hunger, the problem with God, and now I'm merely with them. That might be a good word for your pastor too. And Moses said to Aaron, say to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your murmurings. And as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, they looked toward the wilderness. Behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord said to Moses, I have heard the murmurings of the people of Israel. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat flesh, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God. In the evening, quails came up and covered the camp. And in the morning, dew lay round about the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as hoarfrost on the ground. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, it's the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, each one of you, as much as you can eat. You shall take an omer apiece, according to the number of the persons whom each of you has in your tent. And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing over, and whoever gathered little had no lack. Each gathered according to what they could eat. I just love the economy here. It's so marvelous. The enoughness, that there is enough. My favorite literary definition of the word enough, and maybe contentment, is a part of Give Us This Day as well, is from Dickens' Christmas Carol, when the ghost of Christmas Present says to Scrooge, we're going to go see the houses of the poor. And Scrooge grumbles, the poor, they have enough. And the ghost of Christmas Present laughs, and he laughs and laughs and laughs and says, enough, enough. A wonderful word, enough. It's the power of a prophet, you know, to turn one's own word kind of back on you. The people of Israel have enough. Maybe this is a good time to invoke another verb in Luther's explanation of the petition. What does this mean? One of Tim Wengert, who teaches it at Lutheran Seminary in Philadelphia, says that he thinks in some ways the question is mistranslated. I mean, the question of Luther's catechism has always been translated, what does this mean? But in German, it is, was ist das? Which would literally be translated, what is that? What is that? Give us this day our daily bread. What is that? I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land. What is that? It's the identification. And Luther says, God gives daily bread, even without our prayer, to all people, though sinful. But we ask in this prayer that we will be helped to realize this and to receive our daily bread with thanks. Part of prayer, it seems to me, I'm not sure we see it in the Israelites yet, though I hope it comes, is realization. That part of the satisfaction of hunger isn't merely bread, but realizing that the bread is gift. I think that is the foundation of our prayers at table, mealtime prayers. it is that we would realize that the food is gift. The food is no less nutritious when it's not blessed. But our realization is that prayer is about a realization. And we can spin that both directions. Also a realization of hunger. Realizing you're hungry. I mean, sometimes that comes out crabby. And then you realize, oh, I need to eat. The realization. I love Luther's explanation here. And then, of course, he introduces the verb thanks. That will be fundamentally the verb for Friday when we listen to the prayers of Simeon and Anna at the presentation of Jesus. Comments? Questions? Discussion? You ate a good breakfast.
But do you think God's using this as a teaching tool? I mean, he could have done this organizationally completely differently. In his statement that, you know, I mean, he's gone through the dance and done all of these magical things to get them where they are. Mm-hmm. And now they're singing the blues again, and then he says, okay, I'm going to do this so you'll know I'm your Lord.
Can I comment about that after we've read the next section?
That's a closed question, so I'll say yes.
All right. And I'll start at verse 17. Reread that. And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing over, and whoever gathered little had no lack. Each gathered according to what he or she could eat. And Moses said to them, let no one have any of it till the morning. But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and became foul. Holdenites aren't the first people to have to worry about critters. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning they gathered it, each as much as they could eat. But when the sun grew hot, it melted. On the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, two omers apiece. And when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said to them, this is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake, and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over lay by to be kept till the morning. So they laid it by till the morning, as Moses bade them, and it did not become foul, and there were no worms in it. Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is a Sabbath, there will be none. On the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, and they found none. This is where I think it's so fun to ask the question, how do you see it? How do you envision the scene? It's a wilderness. How many of you have been to the Mideast? Just a few. Well, it gives new meaning to wilderness. We landed and we just crossed the Jordan River. First of all, I should tell you that my wife is a hopeless, hopelessly loyal Minnesotan. Just hopeless. And
I do pretty well in Washington.
You do okay in Washington, yes. We crossed the Jordan River and we're driving through the desert. And Sue said, why on earth would God choose this? And I mean, I knew she was thinking of Bemidji or Brainerd. All those beautiful spots with lakes and trees. It would have been so much nicer. I mean, part of what being there makes these stories so powerful, because you appreciate the desperation of where you would go for food. But I think the really colorful part is I have to believe these people that go out on the seventh day to check are kind of sneaking. Don't you think? I mean, you wouldn't go down Main Street to look. You'd be up behind the chalet watching for bears out of one eye and, you know, just checking to see if it's there. I sometimes like to add, I think a marvelous way into Bible study is to raise a question, with whom do you identify? Who are you in this story? Well, I would be one of those people. Curiosity would just kill me if whether or not there would be any bread out there. question has been raised, is God attempting to feed, to teach the people? What do you think?
Always.
Huh?
Always.
Always, yeah. Maybe we could raise a question another way. Do you think that people need teaching?
Always.
We said, you know, this study in a way is a response to the studies of prior weeks where we talked about what kind of God do we believe in? This is what kind of humanity do we believe in? And I'm grateful after yesterday that Exodus 16 makes no gender distinctions. I mean, they're all obtuse. And Moses is angry and says, how long does it take you to get it? Okay? Because you were told, don't leave it over. It will rot. I think the people need teaching, proving, testing. And if I were going to graph this story, I mean, the thing that I think that's so marvelous is that we see both the responsiveness of God. It says God hears. But we also see the integrity and the faithfulness of God. I mean, God is steady day in and day out. God provides. And these are providential stories. And that steadiness is just a straight line, 6 days, and then this big pause for the seventh, and then God provides again. And the people are all over the map, aren't they? Then you draw this big squiggly line where they're furious because they're hungry, and then they leave some of the food left over, and it rots, and it wastes. And then they've got plenty for the day, but they still go out to look for a little more. Does that sound like a humanity you know? And what happens in all of this to a prayer that we want to describe as hunger? Okay? In some ways, I think we've got the opposite problem of realization that the Israelites had. Food storage in the ancient world, in the wilderness, was a huge problem. And you didn't store food because you couldn't store food. Okay? You take food for the day, and that's all it's good for. Well, we've developed food storage very reliably. We can store food for years, preserve it. But hunger hasn't changed. And you can't kind of stockpile your hunger. The whole industries are developed trying to convince us we can. It doesn't matter how much you eat today, you'll be hungry again tomorrow, right? I will be. I think it's true for everything that really matters. It doesn't matter how much you breathe today, you need to breathe again tomorrow. Hmm? Is there a comment? Or how much you love today, or are loved today. You'll need to be loved again tomorrow. And I guess I would have to say an emphatic yes. God is trying to teach us that God will be faithful.
Well, doesn't that say something about our learning curve then?
Yeah, it probably does.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any parallelism with this story and child rearing? Because the idea of children keep coming back in my mind, and my children. Sometimes my kids don't ask me for something because they don't think I can give it to them. You know, like, well, you don't have a walking stick for me to have. So, well, just ask me, I can get it, you know. And all the things that go with it, you know, learn to trust.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah,
but I think the other thing that I see is that adults really aren't so very much different than children.
Well, yeah, exactly, yeah.
You know? I mean, when we talk about our hungers, talk about a common denominator for all people. I mean, it's right there. And we're all weakened if those hungers, however we define it, aren't responded to. Is your hand up?
Yes. Well, I think he's just paralleling the situation with God and the Israelites to his family situation. And I was noticing that earlier as well. like sometimes I don't really ask for something, but like I think that even if, like, to my parents, I don't always ask for something, and sometimes they'll be like, well, why didn't it happen? And they're like, well, you just didn't ask me. But then other times, I don't always feel like I need to ask God for something, like verbally, like say, God, I need this. I mean, because I know I need it, and I think that, you know, He knows that I need that, but do I have to, should I ask verbally, or?
I think you're using a wonderful verb. There's good discussion at 7:45 about the verb complaint. How, you know, we're ashamed of complaint and what kind of downcast. But I think need is an even more basic verb, I need. And I think that's a difficult admission for us, to be dependent.
Because the passage that was read earlier, the people were groaning, and that wasn't technically a prayer, but God heard it. And sometimes inwardly we groan, I think.
I think so too.
And that's not always prayer, but then, you know, there's the part about, you know, asking God. So I don't know.
Well, so I was teasing about these folks out on the Sabbath day sneaking around, you know, just checking. And I find it helpful to work with opposites. The opposite of sneaking is open, right? Is to be in the open. And the gift of praying our need is that then our need is open. And there is no shame in it. There need not be shame in needing to eat. Or in needing to be loved, or in needing to learn to trust, or whatever. But I think we complicate it if we repress it. And that's probably where adults are different than children, is that we get stuck in mind games, at least I think I do. And that it is a gift of prayer to be able to say, I need. And, well, God, I believe God knows. Maybe we ought to just raise the question, what's helpful? Is it helpful to say it?
Well, it wouldn't hurt.
I tend to be a slightly verbal person, so it's really very helpful for me to be able to say it. To be able to say it, and then it's in the open, and you can deal with it. And I think, you know, when we're talking about these relationships and people who don't ask or don't tell you, I mean, how frustrating it is to not know and to not be in contact. But I can't say the word open too often. And by open, I want to say again, I don't mean public necessarily. But even if language helps you identify it in yourself, for yourself, that's freeing, or with an intercessor, a prayer partner, or whatever. Having said the word open, one of the books that the bookstore stocked for me is Henri Nouwen's With Open Hands. I think is when I talk about the privilege of overhearing the people in the Bible in prayer. Nouwen is one of those people in our own time who has let us hear his prayers, not unlike Roberta Bondi, who is here with us. And he writes very descriptively. And I think about, I mean, Susan read the groaning passage, that we are really stuck until we get things named. That the power of language for us cannot be underestimated. Hyperactive children are often helped a great deal by speech therapy. That their kinetic movement is out of control because they cannot speak. And the power of speech brings the body kind of into balance again. And so to find the words, and these prayers of others help us find our own words and name our own groanings.
Or any simple means of communication.
I didn't hear you, I'm sorry.
Or any other means of communication, like some people are inaudible and they're not able to speak or something, but if they have another means of communication.
Yes.
I think the communicating is the vital part in that, because you're able to, you know that God knows what you need, but communicating that and getting that out into the open and raising that and, you know, pursuing it with God. It's just like anybody else. If you need something from your spouse or your friends or your family, you tell.
Well, you know, the question was raised about child rearing. And I mean, it seems to me that one of the tricky things about raising children is that parents know their needs if they're attentive. Mm-hmm. But part of the nurture is teaching children to own their own needs and take responsibility for them. It's, you know, how long do you need to tell them to go to bed? They need to sleep. And no, that was my question. Come on.
Do you have an answer?
No, I've given you all kinds of neat answers.
I think one of the other things that's difficult in dealing with children is to separate needs from wants. And to answer the question, how much is enough? I mean, here it's answered very factually, one omer per person. But when, you know, we all struggle with how much is enough.
Right.
And to separate our needs from our wants.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then to appreciate the way language functions for us. My very, very favorite Garrison Keillor monologue was the time Pastor Inkvest was ready to go. It was middle of February in Lake Wobegon. Winter, that means winter, for those of you who don't live in Minnesota. And Pastor and Mrs. Inkvest were going to Orlando for the Conference on Rural Ministry. Okay. And he was at the church council meeting, and somebody in the church council had just seen a documentary on world hunger. See, this does apply to this day. And, you know, was just feeling so badly about all those hungry people and just wondering if there wasn't something that, you know, we could do for them. Of course, Pastor Inkvest is just overwhelmed with this statement. And so he says, well, he supposed that they could use his travel allowance, knowing that it would mean canceling to Orlando for the Conference on Rural Ministry. They decided. And then the person on the council who said it said, well, if that's how you feel. And Keillor said, it wasn't how he felt, it's what he said. Important distinction. But you see, when I say to you're talking about the distinction between needs and wants. I regularly will hear people say, I need to get quadraphonic sound. Surround sound. It would be so wonderful. And then after they've described surround sound and where they would put it and what they would play and da-da-da-da, they say, well, then they would say, well, I suppose I don't need it. That there is a sense, this is what I mean by opening, that there is a sense in which saying it helps us sort it. And it's my hope, for example, when we're praying to win, that when we pray it, you know, we all get stuck wondering if God hears it and what God does about the game. It's my hope that we'll hear it. Oh, what did I say? You know? And that our hearing our own voice, our own twisted way of naming this, you know what I mean? That we suffer when when we have either extreme. At one extreme is not taking language seriously at all, and the other thing is taking everything everybody says as the last word. You know, it wasn't what he felt, it's what he said. And he, you know, he of course wanted them to say, oh no, and they didn't.
There's a word that keeps rolling in my mind about the prayer, and it's pride. That would stop a person from praying. And I can see that that would apply in the ability for a person to ask.
Yeah. There's another word that's going to speak directly to that in the next verse. Left off on 20, well, two verses, 27. On the seventh day, some of the people went out together, and they found none. Amazing. And the Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See. Isn't that marvelous? God just says, see. I think that speaks to pride. You know? See your need. Or see this perpetual need to learn, to have it explained again. I suppose one of the most frustrating things about aging is I keep learning things I thought I'd already learned. You know, it keeps coming back. And God says, see. When we were talking at 7:45 about this, the particularity and the definite, there's a really helpful comment. One of the participants said, oh, but memory plays an important role here. Because on some particular day when I'm needing to be loved and not being loved, it helps me to remember when I was loved. I couldn't agree more. And it led me to say, and memory is also a this day experience. Because if some of what the dailiness of the prayer is asking for, some of the need for it, comes out of the amnesia that created the whole problem in the first place. I mean, if the children of Israel could have remembered the Red Sea for even a day more than 6 weeks, I think they'd have phrased their prayer differently. I think they'd have responded to their hungering differently. But it is the... It is this whole business that Luther points us to about realization. God is present each day, every day, faithful providing. Do we realize it? Do we see it? Do we come to some moment in the day where we name it with real, live, specific words for this day? See. The Lord has given you the Sabbath, therefore on the sixth day he gives you bread for 2 days. Remain every one of you in your place. Let no one go out of your place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. Now the house of Israel called its name manna. It was like coriander seed, white, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. And Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omer of it be kept throughout your generations, that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. And Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omen of manna in it and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. Okay? The interesting thing about the book of Exodus is that provision is made for remembering even before it's forgotten. The Passover is commanded even before the plague. There is this steadfast concern that realization will happen, that the memory will be kept, that you will remember that you have been fed. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept. And the people of Israel ate the manna 40 years till they came to a habitable land. They ate the manna till they came to the border of the land of Canaan. An omer is the tenth part of an ephah. I just knew you were wondering. An omer is enough. I think that's the best definition of enough. It is the realization of the freedom of trust that God will provide, and that we speak our need, and that we grumble and moan and complain and murmur our need, even in all kinds of unhealthy third-person ways, because we've not yet come to the place of trust where we can say it. Prayer is the freedom of saying it. I really cherish the text for the way it gives us words with which to say it, and with which it gives us the freedom to hear that people of God have said it and tested it in all kinds of twisted ways. You know, from the very start, it's not like we are the first generation to invent sneakiness. And I think that's so important when you talk about nurturing children, for the way youth and adolescents are talked about. So many times they are diminished as if they're the first generation to test the generation that was nurturing them. Good grief. Remember more than 6 weeks that the relationship of generations, that memory has needed to be nurtured and has not been. Any other comments? Questions? Go ahead, Barb.
I've always wondered, why does God hold Moses responsible for the actions of his people when Moses really didn't apply for the job? And also, why does Moses not complain back to God at all?
Well, he did.
When he does, he's punished.
Well, there are several places he does, though. But the intercessing goes both ways. That's right. The role of the prophet not only represents the people to God, but represents God to the people. And takes it from God when the people are stiff-necked. You know, that's the image of the
people. That's the nature of calling, is that you don't ask for the job, but God calls you to it anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't understand why God uses people in the first place. If I were God. I tell that to my congregation. If I'm not the pastor you want me to be, know this. If I were God, I wouldn't use people. Wouldn't use a human being. They are too limited and they are unreliable. So, go ahead.
Well, since we're talking about Moses, don't you think he got shortchanged at the end? Didn't he get a raw deal?
Because he didn't get to go into the promised land.
He was part of the generation that was not supposed to go.
Yeah.
And that was the deal.
He went.
He took.
Yeah, but that's not what he signed up for.
I mean, that's not at all.
Well, yeah, I know. That's not what I heard when he started. And I always think he got a raw deal.
Are you saying life isn't fair?
We're back to yesterday.
Sure. But let's see if we can milk a little more out of that. Okay.
Like milk and honey and land.
No, we'll just jump ahead to St. Paul wrestling with the thorn. Okay? You know, that just beseeching the Lord that the thorn would be removed. I mean, we don't need to let God off the hook. Let's talk about that. Let's think about that. I took confessions from Warren Quanbeck. Warren Quanbeck had sat on the Second Vatican Council, was a phenomenal, had the confessions memorized in three languages, delivered these incredible lectures from memory. The quarter I took Lutheran confessions from him, he was dying of cancer, and he was so jaundiced, you could hardly bear to look at him. But he taught. It was his vocation. If you've not read Tuesdays with Maury, I thought of him. And then he got too weak to stand, so he sat on a stool. But the lectures were still lucid, definitive, helpful. And he was a teacher. And then he was bedridden. and he taped his lectures. And we gathered in class to listen to this tape recorder of our teacher. And I'm here to tell you, nobody cut class. He died with one lecture left undone. The person who Lloyd Svensby preached his memorial sermon, and he talked about the ever incompleteness. And I mean, I think we can scream at God and say it's not fair. You know, I think if we were God, we want a life that's resolved. I mean, that doesn't have any rough edges. It's hemmed. If that's your metaphor. And God keeps pushing it forward and using incompleteness to do that, as unfair as it seems. I don't know. I mean, maybe it was tragedy, or maybe Moses had had enough. I mean, the movement into the Promised Land was no picnic, you'll recall.
Right.
So, I mean another...
He was taken care of. I guess he came back to Transfiguration and all that.
Well...
Total rotty.
I don't know. Go ahead. Dave?
I guess what I was going to say is that only in this world are you judging whether it's fair or not. I
mean, yeah.
That's not the end of it. Back to the word enough.
Enough.
And I'm not sure that Moses felt as though he hadn't, that he'd been cheated or hadn't had enough.
And hopefully you've known people at the end of their life who were at that place of acceptance. It's a wonderful thing. My grandpa was at 90. I mean, I hadn't had enough. I wasn't ready, but he told my cousin, 90 years is enough. You know, the angina wouldn't stop. It just wouldn't stop, and he said, it's enough now. So I don't, you know, I'm milking, but food for thought. It's to say that it isn't only Moses' life that's incomplete, and we're free to wrestle with that however we need to. Tomorrow, we'll take one of the biggies, Thy Will Be Done. And we will listen to Jesus' prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane as it's recorded in Mark. I think it's chapter 14. Mark 14. But it's the Gethsemane passage in the Gospel of Mark. Thank you for your participation, your discussion. Go in peace.